Good people everywhere are ordering the new DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste. Don't you want to be good? Of course you do. Here's how you do it. Go to my website, thecommentarytrack.com, click on the videos page, there's the film. Click on that, take you to PayPal. Bob's your uncle. Order now, won't you?
The Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 50 of The Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson. I'm a boon, I'm a doer, I'm a dream come a truer. And then some. Both of you who listen to my podcast all the time will know that I lean toward my enthusiasms. I love what I love, and I'm never happier than when I'm talking about things that I really like with people who know all about it. And in some cases, when I'm talking to people that I really admire. And tonight, it's a case of having both all at the same time. My guest is Phil Proctor, member of the Firesign Theater, a great actor, really a remarkable guy on every level. He speaks six languages. He sings in operas. He's done everything. He's been in films with Orson Welles. He's done everything. But the Firesign Theater is where I first encountered him, and that was one of those life-changing things for me. When I was a freshman in college, fresh out of South Carolina, where there is no Firesign Theater, as far as I know, but when I got up to Boston, my college friends and dormitory mates all had the albums, and they started playing them for me, and I took to them like the proverbial duck to water. The surrealism of them struck me right down to the ground. The sense of humor, the incredible use of language, and just these labyrinthian turns that the dialogue and the plots took. And I was a fan immediately and a fan for life. And I can still quote most of their albums verbatim, complete with sound effects. And if you don't watch yourself, I'll do that. And it took every ounce of nerve in my body to keep me from doing that when I was sitting across from Phil Proctor. Because you know, I'm guessing that Phil has never come across a rabid fan who knows all of his work before. Probably has never happened. I tried my best to remain cool, and we had a really, really good conversation. It was a little shorter than most. Well, it comes in at pretty close to an hour, so it's a good, solid interview, and it really does cover a lot of ground, starting off with our mutual idolization of Bob and Ray, and then going on to his acting career and his just so many things. We talk about the Firesign Theater. We talk about the movie A Safe Place that he made with Henry Jaglom that co-starred Orson Welles and Jack Nicholson and Tuesday Weld. And that's a terrible story he tells, but you'll get to that eventually. I didn't realize going in that our time frame was so rigid. The interview ends rather abruptly. His wife, who was looking out for him, he had a gig that night, and he also had a lot of stuff coming up, including surgery, which is over with and which apparently went just swimmingly. So he had a lot on his plate and didn't have a lot of time for the likes on me. And so at one point, about an hour in, his wife just came up and just pretty much said, "Stop it," very nicely. She said it very nicely. And Phil finished the story he was telling, and then we wrapped it up. And the good thing about that is that we talked about getting together again, because this is one of those guys, I could have him on 10 episodes of this length, and we would never even scratch the surface of all the great stories he has to tell. Luckily, he's working on his autobiography, and so a lot of those stories will be put to page, and that will be really cool. So it's this is a really great moment for me, a real thrill for me. to meet somebody that I've admired since I was 18 years old. So more than 3 years, I've been a big, big, big fan. So I hope you enjoy this talk with Phil Proctor, and I'll see you on the other side. On the way over here, I was listening to Bob and Ray. I think we share that members in the secular religion of Bob and Ray. You listened to them early on, right?
Oh, yeah. Bob and Ray and Ernie Kovacs were two of my mentors, one could say. By the time that I'd moved from Goshen, Indiana to New York City and grew up enough to be able to appreciate comedy, Bob and Ray were on the radio on WINS in New York. And it was really the golden age of Bob and Ray in New York, because they were on every morning, 5 days a week, and there was a newscaster named Peter Roberts who would do the news, and they mm-hmm. would make him laugh, because he had an infectious laugh, which ended with a ho-ho where he tried to get his breath. Ho-ho! I mean, incredible laugh. And then he'd make himself laugh, because you'd hear himself laughing. It was just, he'd go on for minutes, losing it. And my mom and I, my dad was kind of an entrepreneur, and he would bring in different kinds of inventions. I remember I have a recording that we did on a vinyl recording machine, home recording machine, and we also had a wire recorder before that. And at this point, we had a recorder with a built-in radio. So I had to get up early to go to the Allen Stevenson School. I was in the Allen Stevenson School Orchestra playing the violin. We became quite famous, and we appeared on local television, and we toured. A fellow named Stanley Gauger put it all together. So I would listen to Bob and Ray when I woke up in the morning, and then my mom would record the show. She'd take out the commercials if she had time to do that. And I would come home and listen to the rest of the show while I did my homework. So I actually had recordings of Bob and Ray. And if things happened that were particularly funny, especially when they used to break up the newsman or some of their skits, or skits where they broke up in the skits, I would save them. I didn't know anything about real tape editing, but with scotch tape and a pair of scissors, I put together a reel of the funniest of Bob and Ray. And many, many, many years later, when I was out here in California, I learned that Larry Josephson, who had done a series of live shows with Bob and Ray, was putting out a collection of the best of Bob and Ray. And I said, "Well, Larry, I have this extraordinary tape. I'd be honored if you'd include it in the collection," which he did.
Great.
So it is available, recorded by Phil Proctor and Audrey, my mother, Audrey Jane Proctor. And of course, I also, it was the first time my writing had ever been read on the air, because I sent a postcard into them saying, "Get well soon," which they read and mentioned my name. And then I sent in another one about Goshen, Indiana, I think, because Goshen, Indiana would show up in some of their skits, where I was born, my hometown.
Sure.
And Elkhart. Because, of course, the thing that endeared them to us so much was that they created comedy out of rural realities. And so they love to use all kinds of references to actual America and American funny names and things like that. So they read both of my postcards on the air. And the only thing I regret about this was that I didn't have the nerve to go down and visit them in the studio. Because they did have people who'd come and sit in the studio.
Sure.
You know, just like the Fireside Theater did when we were doing our radio, during the many years we did radio, we would have kids sitting all around on the floor, you know, in these studios and on the other side of the glass and everything. And you can hear in some of our earlier shows, which have been released now in a collection called The Duke of Madness Motors, 85 hours of Fireside Theater radio shows from our radio years. You can often hear where we have, you know, live audience people sitting under the table laughing at the stuff that we're doing, you know. And it adds a wonderful kind of a little jazzy,
well, sure,
you know, inspiration to what you're doing. But anyway, they were so inspirational because of their laid-back, easy style. The parodies of everything that they did. Parodies of styles of radio, of interviews, of news, parodies of commercials, parodies of soap operas. They even did a parody of the Joseph McCarthy hearings, you know, because Ray did such a dead-on funny imitation of McCarthy and the way he talking, and, you know, and I remember, since I had a tape recorder as well, I used to parody, you know, I started experimenting by doing parodies of commercials and things myself. And Ernie Kovacs was doing this on television. And I would often, I had a Shure microphone with a long, long cord, and I would take it out and stick it in front of the television set, which was in the living room, in the speaker in the bottom, and I recorded a lot of Ernie Kovacs stuff, too. And I used to then, I'd do a transliteration of some of the scripts, and I'd perform them. You know, because there was something again about his surrealistic take on things. Mm-hmm. Bob and Ray were also very surreal, very surreal. But then again, when I look back at like Laurel and Hardy movies, they were very surreal. You know, I think of one sequence in particular where Stan is walking down a staircase in an apartment building, and there's a shadow of an open window, the sun shining through an open window cast on the wall. Mm-hmm. And he goes over and he reaches up and he pulls the shadow of the shade down to the bottom. And then, as he's getting ready to walk further, it flies up and goes flop, 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 and scares him, and he goes running down. And they had a sting of kind of like, I went, wow! Yeah. You know, a cartoon enters the world of science, of silent films. So much of what they did was visually.
Well, Stan had extreme. A kind of a magical quality to him anyway.
Yes.
You know, he would light cigars with his thumb. Mm. He could do the... just lighted and...
Oh, yes, that's right. He'd light a cigar with his thumb. I remember that. That's right.
Always completely flummoxed.
Yeah.
Oliver Hardy.
And of course, the other thing I loved about Laurel and Hardy and their approach to films was that they would go into a test... They'd test screen their movies, and they would clock the laughter that a gag would create. And then they'd cut in, the director would cut in reaction shots to cover the laughter.
Yeah.
Which is why you get these wonderful shots of either Stan, you know, doing something with his hair, looking bemused, or Ollie, you know, turning to the camera and giving a frustrated take to the
looking
audience.
Directly at us.
Directly at us going,
can you believe this?
Can you believe this? You know, and that would help to give the rhythms to the movie. Fireside Theater did that as well in our work, because we would try out material before, like the Marx Brothers used to do.
Sure.
Before they do a movie, they do a vaudeville show up at the Libera Theater in Santa Barbara, and time some of the gags and work out the kinks in the gags, so that when they put them on film, they were as perfect as they could be. And Firesign Theater used to do the same thing with our material down at a place called the Ash Grove on Melrose, which is now the home, has been for decades, of the Improv Comedy Club. And we would work out our material prior to putting it down in a recorded form and releasing it as a record. But again, much of what Firesign Theater had in common was not only love for Bob and Ray and their approach, but the Goon Shows in England, which were total surrealistic comedy. You know, no holds barred, thanks in great part to Spike Milligan. But the whole crew, including the late, great Peter Sellers, were part and parcel of that madness and totally suited to perform and present the craziest, wildest, silliest ideas. And, of course, the English audience, which was raised on storytelling, you know, and the great playwright Shakespeare and the tradition of all of these great playwrights, they were perfect foils for all the stuff that was happening. And, you know, that also, I was introduced late to the Goon Shows through the Firesign Theater when we first got together on KPFK Radio in like 1964 or 5, something like that, because they had been playing it on the station, and they had all these transcripts, which were like large vinyl records, each one representing a Goon Show. Now you can get the Goon Shows I have downstairs on a a CD, I think, every Goon show ever ever broadcast.
Yeah.
The wonder of our modern times. And, of course, I played them for my daughter when she was growing up, so I've completely destroyed her life. And every time I listen to them, there's something that they do, whether it's one of their best shows or one of their worst shows, that completely blows me away, because it's an idea,
yeah,
a surrealistic idea of linking two things together that I would have never thought of, you know, in my life, or had an opportunity to create.
Sure.
And there it is for everybody to enjoy. Oops, oops.
That's them flying over right now.
Yes, that's just a sound effect, folks. Yes. Don't get excited.
It's radio.
They might drop bombs. Says
theater of the mind.
Reminds me of something that happened with Procter and Bergman. Peter Bergman at one point lived on this street, as did, as I told you off microphone, and Margaret. And on this street, the Manson murderers washed their knives off and their clothes on an open spigot just two houses up to my left.
Mm.
And on this street, there was a murder two houses down on my right. You know, it's a typical little quiet,
sure,
canyon, Raymond Chandler-esque street here. But in any event, no, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yes, I know what it was. When Procter & Bergman were touring, which is another whole part of my strange life and career, we played the Playboy Club in Great Gorge, New Jersey, or Rising Gorge, as I call it. A wrong venue for us.
Yeah.
We played college campuses and clubs all over the country and in Canada. But the wrong venue. We're at the Playboy Club. And I remember our first night, a woman opened for us, and it was all like candy music for the audience of salesmen and farmers,
mm-hmm,
okay? And she ended with, "Doe a deer, a glass of beer," you know, that song. And they loved her. She was, you know, charming and cute and sang all the songs that they loved and knew. And then Procter and Bergman. And now the comedy soundings of Procter and Bergman. They didn't know us from Adam.
Sure.
And so we come out and we're doing our TV or not TV material. God knows what it was. And our jokes would fly up over their heads and explode harmlessly, and kind of pieces of the humor would come down into the crowd.
Sure.
I called it high attitude bombing. Our comedy was so far over their heads. It was just in another level of the ionosphere.
It would come down like confetti.
It would. It would just I could see these little sparkling pieces of wit falling onto the floor. And so we went back to our room, and the rooms in this place had carpeting that went up the side of the walls about 5 feet, okay? So you were like in a bowl of carpet,
mm,
which is good because we were banging our heads against,
sure,
the wall. And we rewrote the entire show, and we said, we have to open. You know, we have to open and get it out of the way, and then you can come and salvage the audience so they'll go out of there happy, you know. But we managed to lower the quality of the show enough that it would get through to them. And I remember playing out by the pool was Kaufman, Andy Kaufman.
Mm.
He was playing during the day out at the pool.
Wow.
Yeah, doing his Mighty Mouse bit, you know. And I didn't get to talk to him or anything, but I just thought, my God, this was very surreal, too.
Well, sure.
You know, he was like a schnorrer or a tumbler in the old Catskills, you know, entertaining,
yeah,
the people wherever by the pool or, you know, while they're eating. Or Jerry Lewis did that, you know, dropping stacks of plates,
mm-hmm,
anything to get a laugh. And that was a good place for him to do what he was doing, because he didn't really have to get a reaction.
Sure.
He could just have some fun and be surreal, you know.
So surrealism was interesting to you from very early, right?
I mean, yeah, I took to it like a duck to water, but it's also because I'm from the Midwest, and I'm from northern Indiana. The fact that I'm of Amish and Irish ancestry might have something to do with it, because it's just an absurd combination to begin with, and very surreal at the time, very unknown. There are books about my family called Rosanna of the Amish, Rosanna's Boys. They had five boys, all of went on to do amazing things when they left the Amish community, and is written by my great uncle Joseph W. Yoder. And I sincerely believe that I got a lot of my God-given talents from Joseph, whom I met when I was a kid, because he was once he left the Amish community, he wrote about the Amish community. He wrote about the extraordinary story of his family. And he was an actor, a lecturer, a singer. He wrote down the music of the Amish, probably played some instruments. He taught, he created choral programs in schools throughout the Midwest and Eastern Coast, and physical education programs for schools. So he was a real harbinger of physical culture and musical culture to school systems. One of my other great uncles created the cafeteria system that we use in schools today.
Wow.
At a Mennonite school, Goshen College, in or a high school, I'm not sure which it was, in near Goshen. It was in Goshen. And basically, he saw that a lot of kids coming into school didn't have nutritious meals. Some of them did, some of them didn't. So he said, well, we can grow our own organic food. We can raise chickens and, you know, cows and things, and we can prepare healthy meals for pennies a day for all the kids in the school. And this idea caught on, and of course,
Wow. Cafeteria.
So anyway, when I was a baby, my grandfather, this is in Goshen, where I was born, my grandfather was singing a hymn to me or a lullaby, and I hummed it back to him. So he scooped me up out of the crib, brought me downstairs, and did it again, and I apparently hummed back to the audience. First time I ever worked for free, and the last. Okay? I was, you know, freshly back from the hospital or something. And my mom remembers this and told me it's true, it really happened. And people have said, well, no, that can't happen. But I have we worked with the Starland Vocal Band. We did a summer replacement show with them back in the 80s, I guess it was. A show that introduced David Letterman as a comedian to the nation, by the way. And one of the members of that incredible group who were responsible for the great hit Afternoon Delight,
sure.
One of them had a baby with another member of the singing group, and I have a recording that he sent me, cassette. Remember what cassette recorder?
I remember.
Okay, it was unreal, reel to reel, and in it he's playing the guitar and singing to his little baby, just back from the hospital, and the little baby starts to sing along, and so there's even more proof that it can happen if you're genetically inclined and have an ear for music and music becomes a part of your life. So not only that aspect, that my entire family sang and harmonized and had the musical gift and instrumental gift. My mom played the piano and the organ and all that. But we also, they all had wonderful senses of humor. And I can remember, you know, at various ages in my life, as I became more conscious, sitting around a kitchen table, you know, with people smoking and drinking and telling wonderful, funny stories, you know, one after another. And many of them were very surrealistic, very surreal stories. So it was a tradition. I grew up in a tradition of comedy, you know. Amish, Jewish, same thing.
Sure.
You know? And good food, you know, and laughs and singing. I had a very joyful family-oriented upbringing in the Midwest. And we found that when we toured, whether it was Firesign Theater or Procter & Bergman, that most of our best audiences were from the Midwest. And we would get invited back to clubs in the Midwest more than anywhere else in the country.
Well, I grew up in South Carolina, but the only time I saw you live was Procter & Bergman in Chicago. So I was in the Midwest when it happened. But I'm interested in the surrealism thing because I loved surrealism from before I knew the word. I loved inexplicable things, still do.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in my 20s and first hearing the Firesign Theater, all my druggy friends would say, "Oh, you have to be high, to really like this stuff." And I was not a druggy, and I said, "No. It's surreal.
Yeah.
It's perfectly wonderful, just listening to it as it is."
Well, Frank, you were obviously born high. You see,
yes, so. I was.
Yeah,
and remain so. Yes,
and you know there are many people over the almost 50 years that I've been involved with Firesign Theater who would come up to me and say, "Oh, you saved my life," because I thought I was the only person who thought this was funny, or not us, that saw things in this kind of funny perspective.
Sure.
And, you know, and now I realize there are many of us. You know, I called it a bad head cult.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm suffering from a bad head cult. And also, there are like these hip pockets all around the backside of America. You know, down south or in the west. And it didn't matter exactly where it was, up in Canada. And once people realized that this was a kind of humor, a high kind of humor that they could understand and appreciate, they could seek out like-minded people and get married.
Well, it was also Feinstein Theater was also a kind of lifesaver at the time, because what people tend to forget about the 60s is that the hippies were generally a fairly humorless group.
That's right.
And took themselves very seriously.
That's right.
And it was really a breath of fresh air to have Feinstein Theater and, to a certain extent, Frank Zappa. I mean, there were a couple of things that started happening at the time.
That's right.
We were just starting to get in... acquainted with Monty Python at that time too, around mid-70s.
Well, Python was later, really. But what you raise is a very interesting observation, because when Life magazine did an article about us, and we were also on the cover of various other new hip magazines, we were called the Jesters of the Rock Generation, and it's true that the entire genesis of Feinstein Theater was based on a parody of New Age thinking, all right? And when we get around to it, we can talk about the one of the movies that we did. One was called Martian Space Party, and it was a surrealistic, national surrealistic white people's party convention.
Sure.
Parody thing. And then Everything You Know Is Wrong. But in those days, we indeed, I would say based on the inspiration of Peter Bergman, who was doing his Radio Free Eyes show, which was in some aspects a put-on of serious psychic investigation. It was like Art Bell on acid.
Sure.
In a way. And we were hired on as a troupe of players to basically portray characters, to parody the interests and focuses of, sincere interests and focus of the New Age thinking, astrological, tarot readings, fortune, psychic realities, flying saucers, abductions, the Indian culture, the Aztec culture, you know, great stories of the past and the future of our world, and higher consciousness and meditation, all of that stuff, but from not such a serious perspective, more a comic perspective. And Bergman, as the Wizard of Oz, he'd do tarot readings for people over the radio, you know? Or he'd talk somebody down from a bad acid trip on the air. But he'd be playing Ravi Shankar, Ragas, and things like that, and whirling dervish records, and hip old great black artists, rock and roll, because he grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and you know, one of the centers of the Motown sound and of the revolutionary black rock and roll music, and so it was a great mixture of all of these influences, cultural influences. And even the way that I met Bergman was surreal. I'd gone to Yale with Peter Bergman back in from 58 to 62. He was in a class ahead of mine, 61. His roommate was Bob Grossman, who did the famous Airbrush album cover for Don't Crush That Dwarf Hand Me the Pliers, and is still a good friend of mine back in New York. And I had come out to Los Angeles with a show called The Amorous Flea, which is a musical that I won a Theater World Award for in New York. And we played at the Las Palmas Theater. Then I went back and I did another Broadway musical. And after that, I ended up understudying Brandon DeWilde, who I'd been fated to meet. I was asked to understudy him when I was in grade school, about eight years old. And I turned it down. I was shy and silly. Turned it down. So many years later, in the 60s, I end up understudying Brandon DeWilde in a play called A Race of Hairy Men by Evan Hunter. And, of course, we became very close friends because we were fated to meet. And I'll be talking about all this. I'm finally working on my autobiography, and it's basically called Where's My Fortune Cookie, which I can explain to you later. But it's my psychic and psychedelic path in life, which is quite extraordinary. And here's an example of it. So we connect up with Peter Fonda because Brandon at the time was trying to change his career from an acting career to a musical career. And he had trained to play the guitar, which he did quite well, and to sing. And Peter also played the guitar and sang. And so I think that was the connection. But Peter Fonda introduced us to a guru named Jacques Honduras out in Eagle Rock. And for the first time, I studied higher consciousness and meditation and began to realize I'd self-studied self-hypnosis and was always fascinated with the workings of the unconscious mind and all of that. And so this was formalizing it for me. I was going, I knew that. Oh, yeah, I see you can go there and you can go here. Oh, and there are chakras. Oh, yeah, and you can meditate on the chakras. And then you can have an invisible life and you can actually set things into motion by setting goals in your head. Of course, that makes sense. You know, and then your subconscious helps you fulfill them. But you're also now linking into a subconscious world or a higher world. And things are going to happen. And I have a million stories about how I've influenced the whole course of my life by using these techniques. But we became all pals and used to hang out together, Fonda, DeWilda, and me. And one of the things that Peter was doing was he was working on a little movie idea called Captain America. About a trip across the country on motorcycles with cocaine. Well, the Marvel Comics wouldn't let him use the name Captain America, so it got changed to, what was he? Easy Rider?
Yes.
Okay. So he's doing research on this, he and Dennis. But Brandon and Peter and I go down to a gathering of people to protest a curfew on youth on the Sunset Strip. Okay? And so we're all down there with a gathering of thousands of young people who are basically saying, you're not going to impose a curfew on us. You know, leave us alone. We're finding our new life. And they put the L.A. police on one side of Sunset Boulevard, and they put the sheriffs on the other side, and they did their classic pincer movement, where they push everybody together to create an artificial riot.
Sure.
And then they declare this is a riot, and they go in and arrest people, break up the thing. So Peter and Brandon and I are part of a sit-down protest, which is part of this event, in front of Pandora's Box, a famous hippie hangout at the time. And I sit down on an open edition of the L.A. Free Press. I pull it out from under my ass, and I have sat down on a picture of Peter Bergman. Peter Bergman. It says, a KPFK newsman, Peter Bergman, interviews returning Vietnam War veterans. I said, oh, he's with KPFK. I'll have to give him a call. And then the police started beating everybody up. Brandon got beaten up. Peter got arrested. I was writing for the East Village Other at the time as a West Coast correspondent, some crazy job I created. And I held up my card, and the cops just flowed around me. I lived to tell the tale and wrote about it and sent it on. So I called up Peter Bergman the next day, went down to KPFK. He said, I'm the Wizard of Oz on Radio Free Oz. I said, of course you are. And I'd known Peter, as I said, at Yale. He'd written the lyrics for the songs in two musicals that I'd starred in, written by Austin Pendleton, Tom Jones, where I played the title role, and Booth Is Back in Town, where I played Edmund Booth, not John Wilkes, but the younger brother.
Yeah.
And so we'd had, you know, a relationship, although we hadn't hung out together or anything, and we hadn't played together on the radio or done any of that stuff. I did that with a guy named Victor Miller, who wrote Friday the 13th later on and worked on a soap for many years. It was an amazing time at Yale. I just have to make a quick aside. In my years at Yale, John Badham, Peter Hunt, Richard Baltby Jr., Sam Waterston, my classmate, we did a lot of shows together, Billy Hennett, Skip Hennett, who did the Electric Company for many years, I can't even remember some of the other wonderful people who were there. In the drama school, I worked with Joan Van Ark and Dan Travanti, among others, but it was an amazing time, a great aggregation of really, really, really talented people who went on to this day to have a real influence on movies and Broadway shows and television and all the rest of it. So, that's another story. So I came out of there, reuniting with Peter was a very easy and fun and surprising thing to do. But that was, it all came out of just sitting on that open edition. Because people had talked to me about Radio Free Oz. I hadn't heard it. But they said, there's this guy. He comes from the East Coast. He's very smart and very funny. You'd love him. You'd love this guy. And it turned out, you know, he's my old pal, Peter Bergman. So.
Wow. Now, I know that you started out to become an actor. Were you influenced, since this is ostensibly a movie podcast, were you a movie guy when you were a kid? Did you were you influenced by movies? Did you really love them, or did you always just want to stage act?
No, my uncle Clarence Urist was a an AD in the film industry, and he worked with Abbott and Costello. He shot all the second unit stuff for their TV show. All the shots of the L train going by and all that stuff. And he used to come into New York and bring me movie props and give me movie props from, from horror movies and things like that. And he also worked, fortunately or unfortunately, with John Wayne. And one of the films that he shot with John Wayne was the Genghis Khan movie out on the irradiated testing site. And it killed him. It killed almost everybody who worked on that movie.
Yeah.
He got cancer.
The Conqueror.
The Conqueror. Death conquers all, and that's what killed him. But he was. I also met Jerry Lewis through him. Although I had met Jerry Lewis in New York on one of the first telethons, I presented him with a check from Alan Stevenson School when I was a kid. My first television job. I was 9 years old, and I did a show called Uncle Danny Reads the Funnies, which was an improvised show where we'd comment for 15 minutes on the Daily News comic strips, and it was shot in a studio at the Daily News. So I had early influence with early activity on television. But as a kid, my family loved the theater and movies. So I got to see, you know, Mary Martin in South Pacific, and I got, as a kid, I got to see all these great musicals on Broadway. And I also, my dad was a great fan of silent movies, and we'd go to the silent movie theater and see Buster Keaton and Chaplin and Abbott Costello and Laurel and Hardy and many, many, many other great silent films. But as I got older, obviously, I started watching movies. And I remember I was a particular fan of the horror genre.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved getting scared in the movies and seeing the early Frankenstein films. You know, And we had a tradition in Goshen that influenced me greatly. It was called the Saturday Club or Saturday Matinee. Many other people, children, my generation probably grew up with a similar event. What it was that basically your parents or your grandparents could park you in the local movie theater for 4 hours while they went and caught up with the rest of their lives. And we would be treated to cliffhanger serials, westerns, and cartoons, and short films of all different kinds, including some of the, I won't be able to remember his name now, but, what's going to happen to him? The something-something shorts. I should have done some research on this point. But there were a series of short films about how to do things where the star of the short films would always fall off a ladder or, you know, slip off a roof or whatever, with wonderful slapstick things.
Like Joe McDoakes?
Joe McDoakes might have been his name. But there's the name of the guy who created this whole series was at the title of the film, and I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, Pete Smith Specialties. Yeah. There you go. Pete Smith Specialties. So we'd spend a whole afternoon, me and my buds, watching these great movies. And then, of course, we'd go out, and I'd become Batman, you know, throw a towel over your shoulders and, you know, put on a mask and, you know, have adventures. And in fact, in the Midwest particularly, I was able to indulge my theatricality physically, because what we would do is we would ride on our bikes through the alleys and find packing crates, haul them back to our backyard, and build spaceships and, you know, tanks and PT boats and have adventures. And there was this one guy, Dayton Dallas. Quinn Robinson and Dayton Dallas were neighbors. And Dayton was really, really handy with his hands. He was like a carpenter, natural-born carpenter. So we built a tree house, which was our clubhouse. I remember the rocket ship that we built once was about 30 feet high, and it was four 2x4s in a box configuration with cardboard sides, and then we drew instruments and things on the inside. And we'd go up through, had a ladder that went up through the center of it. And we were taking off one day and shaking the ship to simulate the takeoff, the engines and everything. And all of a sudden I heard this great crack. And the next thing I know, I'm in midair, suspended in midair. And then there's this tremendous crash. And when I wake up on the ground, I look around and I see Quinn Robinson hanging from a clothing line. And I see the rest of us scattered all over the ground. The ship, the 2x4 had broken, the whole thing had fallen over. So what we did was we kind of created a burned out area around the ship, and we charged a nickel for kids to come and see the crashed rocket ship that we tried to take off in. We did things like that all the time. We'd build ramps and ride our bikes over ramps through flaming hoops and things. Oh man, we were fearless. Fearless kids. But it gave me an opportunity to take stuff that we saw in the movies and realize it in our own life as young actors, if you will, you know. So, yes, movies had that kind of a physical, real physical influence on me. And then getting to meet people like Jerry Lewis on the set of one of his films, thanks to my uncle, where he showed me his revolutionary through-the-camera recording device and all of that. I later got to work with Jerry in a couple of TV shows, you know.
Did you admire him?
Oh, yes, I did. Well, he was very surreal, too.
Oh, yeah.
And the childishness of his comedy and the outrageousness of his comedy and the romance of his comedy was such that like many other people, had a great influence on me. But so did the Abbott and Costello movies, the early Abbott and Costello movies, which probably some of your audiences don't really know anything about. Because what they
my audience does.
Okay, yes. All right, yeah, of course they would. And the same as the Three Stooges. You know, they would make movies on sets of other movies that were going on. You know, so Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein. You know, Abbott and Costello meets the Voice of Empire's name, Bela Lugosi, that one. You know, all of those parodies and things. I loved that kind of stuff, and I was always very greatly attracted to them, and would anxiously await their release so I could go and see them. But in those days, in the 40s and early 50s in New York, you could also have movies in your apartment, shown in your apartment. And I remember watching some Red Skelton movies in my family's apartment in New York. A guy would come in with a screen and a projector, and you invite people over, and you have a movie party.
Wow.
I saw Fuller Brush Salesman there, and another one where he was a milkman. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have all these memories of films. Really, when I think about it, radio, films, TV, all of it was, and even buying little movies and showing them 16mm movies. I had my own projector, and I made movies. I had a 16mm projector, I mean a camera, and then I graduated to a Super 8. And I have a whole box full of movies right down there now that I'm going to take and have transferred onto DVD so I can take a look at them.
Sure.
As part of the research I'm doing.
Keep
for my
the
book.
Film.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, I was always interested in making movies as well. But I found recording sound and doing radio style things easier. You know, there was no direct step between me and the microphone. You know, same as singing as opposed to playing the violin. At a certain point in my young career as an learning how to act, I went from Alan Stevenson, where I sang and played the violin, doing Gilbert and Sullivan, playing the female leads in Gilbert and Sullivan pieces, because Alan Stevenson has a tradition of doing a Gilbert and Sullivan piece every year, and the years that I did mine, I was Phyllis in Iolanthe, and I was Mabel in The Pirates of Penzance. And I always had this natural facility to be on stage. I felt totally comfortable singing and acting on stage, and I always have. But anyway, radio was, again, no rehearsal. You know, you could write up an idea or something. no costumes, no waiting around on the set, you know. Didn't even need an audience, you know. So that was always a wonderful thing. By the way, in the new Bob and Ray book, which I highly recommend to everyone.
Read it.
Uh-huh.
The author is on this show.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Jonathan Schwartz is mentioned, as well as Jeffrey Lyons, as being great fans. Now, Jeffrey Lyons and I went to school together, Alan Stevenson School, along with his brother Warren Lyons. And their father, who wrote a column called The Lion's Den, I also knew because when I was working on Broadway, after the show we'd go to Downey's or some other nice place and hang out, and he would come around and interview various stars and me sometimes about what we were doing and what was coming up next, and it would be in the paper the next day. This was Leonard Lyons. So Warren had the ability of music, and I knew him right up to his death about 2 years ago. He lived out here, and we played and sang together many, many times. And Jeffrey is still a commentator about the movies. And Jonathan Schwartz lived in my building on East 94th Street. His father, Arthur Schwartz, was a famous composer.
Sure.
And Jonathan and his family lived in the penthouse at 139 East 94th Street, two blocks away from where the Marx Brothers apartment building was, across from the 92nd Street Y, which I performed at several times. And Jonathan had an early interest in radio, so he figured out a way to broadcast on a shortwave radio set through our apartment building. And he would go and slide the days, you know, his show, what he was going to do. And he was a disc jockey, and he played music and did a radio show in our apartment building. And I remember what was odd to me about it was that he did commercials, too. He'd do like a commercial for Coca-Cola or something. And I thought, well, why is he doing this when it could be, didn't use the word, free-form radio. He could do whatever he wanted, and it would be different from other radio. But Jonathan was grooming himself to become a DJ, which he did quite successfully. And he, too, had been influenced by Bob and Ray, and he, too, obviously figured out that radio was a cool way to go and build a career for himself from an early age.
Well, in trying to do real surrealism, radio seems to me to be the perfect medium for it, mm-hmm. because you merely need to say something, and it becomes real. And that's what I love about Firesign Theater, particularly, is that simply because of the wordplay, they could set up something, and then it becomes completely different.
That's right.
Rocky Rococo at your cervix.
That's right.
Well, that's different than what you thought it was going to be.
That's right. And yet, you know what is being said on that level, and it vibrates on a lot of different levels. But what it always meant to me was that we were making also strange synaptic connections to go from one place to another in plot. Simply by saying we were someplace, we could be someplace. The Goon Shows did, too. And I always thought that what we were doing was kind of exercising the brain, because we were playing with, to me, the way the brain works, which is associative thinking on conscious, unconscious and unconscious levels. And that memory is made up of strange associations, not clear, you know, across-the-board associations, but strange associations, which Freud brought out when he began analyzing dreams and all of the investigators of the mind and the way the mind works in early psychiatric studies. We're also investigating on how symbolism plays such an enormous part and surrealism plays such an enormous part in the way that we actually think and perceive of the world. And the psychedelics, the use of drugs and things like that, for me at least, was representative of that. Because if I was high on acid, experimenting with a little trip to see what it's all about, and I looked at a wall and I said, gee, that looks like a star field, you know, because it had sparkles in it, I would see a star field. And I went, I see. Look at my face in the mirror and go, that looks like I've got tattoos on my face. Oh, I have tattoos on my face. It didn't scare me. It was like, I see, mind manifesting.
Yeah.
You think it and you can see it. And therefore, that's how you make your world, how you perceive your world. But we did other surrealistic things, like when we did our movie, Everything You Know Is Wrong, we lip-synced it to our voice track.
Yes.
because it was basically we were given some money, like $10,000, for a promotional film to promote the album. And we figured out the only way that we could actually do it was if we didn't have to record it. We'd just pick out the sections we wanted to do it, play the record, and lip sync it. And it came off pretty well, you know?
Yeah.
I watched it just recently. Okay. And it was our cinematographer was Alan Davio. And Alan, at that point, was using it as a way to get into the union.
Wow.
And he actually was a trailblazer in getting into the photographers' union. I don't know the whole story. Alan would have to tell it to you sometime. But they were like, it was an old boys' union, right? If your father was a cinematographer, his son could become a cinematographer, but Alan Davio couldn't become, because
sure,
he was, you know, a renegade. So Alan actually like sued the union to change those rules so that talented people could get into the cinematographers union. And of course, he's gone on to have a fabulous and wonderful career. But Firesign was slated to do an original movie called Eat back in the late 60s, I think it was. And a fellow named Jerry Bryant, whose nickname was Wacko, was going to produce it for us. And it was going to be kind of like a Kentucky Fried movie.
Hmm.
We were going to do a surrealistic comic film. And it had a particular plot about, I think, trying to make a movie. And the title Eat came out of the opening sequences was, the Firesign Theater presents, and then the letters of the Firesign Theater, like bulbs, all burn out until all we had left was EAT, in theater, EAT, mm-hmm. And it started flashing, and we pulled back, and we realized that it was the big sign on the top of a diner saying EAT, and then the movie went inside, and we started. What happened was that Jerry Bryant went on a vacation to Hawaii with his girlfriend, Una Elliott, and he drowned in a riptide.
Ooh.
And that kind of just took the wind out of our sails, and we didn't proceed with the project. I wonder to this day what would have happened if we had proceeded with it. There were other times we were asked to participate as actors in Death Race 2000, I think it was called, something like that. And unlike one of the things about the Firesign Theater is that we all came from kind of different backgrounds. My background was very strongly acting oriented. Phil Austin's was acting oriented as well. Peter Bergman's was more intellectual radio, although he made some movies. He did a movie called Flowers over in Germany, in Berlin, which is another whole story about how he was saved from the draft and thrown into this colloquium in Germany by Lyndon Johnson. Please don't ask. But he was not a trained performer. And David Osman was more of a poet, and also had a career like as a newsman back in New York. So it was whenever an offer would come for some kind of an acting thing, I was always right up at the front. But the other boys were less enthused by it. And so there were several opportunities that we had to become more visually and nationally known that unfortunately did not manifest. So for better or for worse, the underground comedy aspect of our careers prevailed, and the hippie aspect of our careers prevailed, because that was the like the Beatles, we wanted everything to be a total agreement. Everybody had to agree that we were going to do a certain project, and if that didn't happen, the project didn't happen. And that's the path that our careers took.
Now, you and I have something in common besides our striking good looks.
Yes.
And that is that I played Rolf in a little theater production of
The Sound of Music.
Yes.
Oh.
And, it was South Carolina, so it's,
yeah,
you know,
okay,
it wasn't a national stage. But I'm not quite clear. You understudied for a while, but then you went on a touring company.
Yeah.
Did you play Rolf. The role then?
Yeah, I understudied the role on Broadway. And I got to work with Richard Rodgers, because Richard Rodgers directed everybody who went into that show.
Wow.
So that was a great thrill. That was worth the whole thing. And I was in the show, because understudies were in the company. And I played Nazi soldiers, and I played their guests at the big party where the kids do their so long, good night, and I was paired in that part of the show with Richard Rogers' mistress, who is this beautiful big blonde with the voice of an angel. And the only problem was that she was bipolar. So some nights when we were improvising out in the garden behind the set where the kids were going to come in and sing and call us all in, she would be perfectly coherent, and we'd have our champagne glasses and, you know, and talk about how was your day and, you know, what. And other times she was totally incommunicado. Her eyes would be up and looking up into the sky, and she'd maybe stop and say, you know, my angel told me that tomorrow's going to be a very good day. And I go, oh, good, I'm glad to hear that, you know. So that's just a funny little side story. But I had a very pleasant time. I loved working on Broadway. And whenever I'd audition for anything on Broadway, I could go from my dressing room to over to another theater and read for it, you know. And I did a fair share of Broadway shows. And loved it and would certainly do it again. But don't let anybody not tell you it's hard work. Hard work. And off-Broadway was even harder work, because the off-Broadway schedule, when I was doing the musical The Amorous Flea, based on Molière's School for Wives, the show that brought me out here eventually, we did Tuesday through Sunday shows, and the weekend schedule were two shows back-to-back on Saturday night, and then a matinee and a Sunday evening. So, I don't know how I survived. We have Monday and a little bit of Tuesday off, and then you go back and do the same thing again. As one old Corrine once said to another actor, Broadway's not for sissies, honey. It's hard work.
I've always wanted to hear the score for Jerome Morris's A Time for Singing.
Oh.
I've always heard that it's great, but I've never. But you were in that, right?
Yes, I was. And actually, it was on the radio about 2 months ago. A friend of mine named Gary Hollis does a show called Saturday on Broadway on K. Mozart, every Saturday at like 10 o'clock, 10 to 11, 10 to 12. And he's an old friend of my wife Melinda's, Melinda Peterson. And so he knew that I'd done this show, and I have a recording of it. I can lend it to you, or so I'll send you an MP3 of it.
Oh, thank you.
And he interviewed me and then played the show in its entirety on the air. And the music is absolutely stunningly beautiful. And that musical... That musical should have had a long and healthy run on Broadway. It was based on How Green Is My Valley, the book, and then the famous heartbreaking film.
Sure.
And it was a wonderful adaptation of the story. But and it was produced by Alexander H. Cohen. And my mom and I actually put some money in the play ourselves. Had a great, great cast, including George Hearn, who went on to great fame. Jerome Morris, music was brilliant. And... John Morris, wasn't it?
Jerome. Yeah.
I guess the Morris is confused. The Morris boys. And Gerald Friedman directed it brilliantly. And we had Gowrie Champion came in to help with some of the choreography. Theonia Aldridge did the costumes. Ming Cho Lee did the set, which was a rotating set that almost killed one of the dancers. Little Patty Mount was run over by one of the walls, but she survived. And we had... great previews. We had audiences lined up around the block to come and see this, because it was a great family musical. And then we opened to mediocre reviews, followed by a newspaper strike.
Oh.
And it killed the show, because we couldn't publish the good reviews. You know, and they didn't get good reviews, they closed. And the audiences just disappeared, and we played, you know, like a couple of weeks, and this whole beautiful, huge show had to close down, and it should have had a long, long, wonderful run on Broadway. But, you see, it's a show business is also about luck and chances, and, you know, I've had my share of both good luck and bad luck, as we all have in our business. But in the movies that I've done, I've ended up being in a lot of surrealistic movies, like Amazon Women on the Moon, okay? Because of my career as a comic actor, I would be used to do that. And I did a show called No Soap Radio, which is a surrealistic comic variety show on the radio, on television, rather, mm-hmm. with John Roquette. Every comic who has gone on to have their own series or do their own stuff was on that show. And I also, the serious film that I did was Henry Jaglom's A Safe Place.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that.
Okay, if we can talk on, I'll be happy to. A Safe Place was based on a play that he wrote called The Snowball Tree, which is based on a Russian song called Kalinka, which I may have taught him, I don't know, because I went to the Soviet Union with the Yale Russian Chorus in 1959, rather, and sang on street corners and public squares all over the Soviet Union. That's where I learned to speak Russian. And when I came back, Henry was working for the Actors Studio Playwrights Division, and we became friends on various, on a personal level. This is my wife, Melinda.
Nope.
Just come here. And
do we need to wrap it up?
No, I've got to finish this story.
Okay.
And so we did a reading of the play at the Actors Studio, starring Karen Black, Bonnie Bedelia, Richard Pryor, Charlie Dierkop, and me, among other actors. And Henry then went on to edit Easy Rider and became affiliated with BBS Productions. And they gave him the money to make a film out of The Snowball Tree, which became A Safe Place. Karen, at that time, had become a Scientologist and didn't want anything to do with Henry because she was finding a new path for her life. But Henry, I introduced Karen to Henry originally, and Henry was really responsible for helping to get her involved in movies, and did several films with her later on. So Tuesday Weld did the film instead, because the story was actually based on Henry's friendship with Tuesday. And that, I was doing Firesign Theater at the time that this was going on, and they had a radio show. But I took a hiatus from that to go to New York and shoot the film for several months. And there were many stories. Some other time we could talk about some of the strange things that happened. But one of the examples of, for those of you who don't know the movie, it stars Tuesday Weld, Orson Welles, Jack Nicholson, Gwen Wells, and me. Introducing Phil Proctor. And in Henry's new book, My Lunches with Orson,
mm-hmm.
You can hear how that was how he met Orson Welles. And you'll hear some of the interesting stories about Orson's involvement in that movie. But there was one sequence where my character, Fred, I'm picked up by Tuesday Weld, and I think that I'm going to get laid. Instead, she has decided that I look strong enough to carry a dog that has died down to the ASPCA in a suitcase because they don't deliver. They don't pick up mm-hmm. on weekends. And as I'm heading down there in this story, somebody steals my suitcase with the dog in it, mm-hmm. okay? And I have to come back and tell her this, and she says, oh, it doesn't matter. So in the movie, Henry's debating, how are we going to shoot this? Should I use a real dog or a stuffed dog or a coat or something that looks like a dog? Because it's just supposed to be a shot of the dog in covered with ice in a bathtub, and then the rest is in your imagination. Sure. He decides to use a real dog, and he decides that the funny thing would be to use a St. Bernard, because then I have to carry a really heavy dog. So he hires a St. Bernard. St. Bernard comes in. They tranquilize it. They put it in the bathtub. Tuesday and I go in, put on, you know, fake ice cubes, and the dog is snoring, actually, but it's an MOS shot without yeah. sound. So we go in, and I, you know, oh my God, it's a dog, and, you know, this is where the whole thing changes for me. I'm not going to get laid. I'm going to have to do what with this crazy girl. And, okay, one shot, wrap the shot, they give the antidote to the dog to revive it. The dog died.
Yikes.
The dog died. And the real tragedy of it is that when Henry looked at the dailies the next day, didn't look real. The dog didn't look real. The shot didn't work.
Hmm.
It didn't sell the story. And he cut the whole subplot.
Wow.
And replaced it with this this thing that made the movie even more confusing about her magic box, which is, of course, what I was interested in the first place.
Sure, of course.
So that's the way things happen.
It's a sad story.
It is a sad story, yeah. But again, it's, you know, making movies.
Yeah. Well, I know you have to go, and I regret that very much, because I want to talk to you for about 7 more hours.
Well, we can do this again.
Let's do it again,
okay.
Shall we?
Sure, I'd love to.
Thank you very much. I really
appreciate
it.
Pleasure.
Boy, was that a fun talk for me. He can really tell a great story. He's a self-starter, too. I like that. I just sat at his knee, metaphorically speaking, and just let him tell me all these stories, and I could not have been more tickled. You can find out a lot more about him and Firesign Theater from two websites. I'm going to post them on the links page on the Commentary Track website. First is firesigntheater.com, and that'll give you news and blogs and also a lot of their products. They sell books. They sell CDs. As a matter of fact, there's a CD book combo available that contains all of their radio work. I think it's something like 80 hours of their radio work. And man, oh man, if that isn't just a little dip into paradise for me. So go to firesigntheater.com. And to be more specific about Phil Proctor, his website is planetproctor.com. And again, I'll list both of these on the links page on my website so you can find them. And I highly suggest that you do, because there's a lot going on there. And if you're a Firesign Theater fan like I am, and I bet there's some of you out there. As a matter of fact, I know some real rabid ones, and it's just get us together, and we start doing Nick Danger Third Eye, and you can't stop us. People will just empty the room while we stand there and recite lines to each other. And you know who you are. So, this has been great fun, and let me do my thank yous. First, I want to thank my perfect wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. Thanks to James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Please visit them both, won't you? And, of course, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for their wonderful, wonderful theme music that I enjoy so much every week. And today I want to add an extra thank you to Phil Proctor for letting me come by his wonderful house on the what turns out, as you heard in the interview, turns out to have quite a bloody history, that street he lives on. But you would never know it from the peaceful surroundings that we did the podcast interview in. It was bucolic. It was nice. So, we will do that again with him, and next week we will have another fine guest that I know you're going to be fascinated by. So, thank you very much for coming by, and by the way, don't you worry, we're going to fix it in post.